The medium is the message, money makes a dance. Love is the product, the joke is in, the joke is in, the joke is in your pants.
I'm Are You Serious? And this is my show.
Natural disasters, and eventually the end of the world.
Are you serious?
They wrecked my genitals. Internet for assholes, and my pussy is still on fire. We are back with part two of the GettingIt.com interview. But before we go into that, I'm looking over at Jeff Deal, twiddling some knobs, Steve Robles. Are we doing a Beavis?
Twiddling
we're
going to
do the Beavis and Butthead act today.
today.
Diana Brown is laughing wickedly.
Well, you know, you mentioned twiddling knobs, and that's just a euphemism, but it seems that ChristianNet.com, a website proclaiming itself as the world's most visited Christian website in the world, issued a press release reporting that in a recent opinion poll, evangelical Christians, might as well face it, they're addicted to porn. ChristianNet cited the results of 1,000 responses to an 11-question online opinion poll, then sought an additional opinion from Second Glance Ministries in evaluating the results.
Second Glance?
Yeah, I guess they wanted a second opinion. And Clay Jones, founder and president of Second Glance Ministries, was proud to say that 50% of all Christian men and 20% of all Christian women are addicted to porn. Apparently, 60% of the women admitted to having significant struggles with lust, 40% admitted
struggles.
To being involved in sexual sin in the last year, and 20% of church-going female participants struggle with looking at pornography on an ongoing basis.
That's all this talk about addiction. Everything is addiction. You know, it's like you're not supposed to look at porn 7 times a day. And why is, you know,
well, this
we're
is,
addicted
we, where
to
did
addiction,
we get
man.
This idea that everything is an addiction?
Well, because, you know, either it's good or it's bad. There's no middle ground, apparently.
Yeah, I guess so.
Now, Peter, it serves the interest of the church administration. To have their all their flock addicted to porn, because then they feel
they
guilty and sin.
You know, that's exactly right. Because one of these
Thank
organizations.
You. That's all I ever.
That's all
we
ever wanted.
Jeff nailed it again.
Yeah. Once again, Jeff is exactly right.
Everybody applaud.
How many shows is this? Like 120 shows. So, you know, you're finally right.
Do
Might
I?
Have to wait another 120.
Now, the organizations do go on to say, you know, that we're here to help. We're here to help you step away from those unsightly.
See, Christians, Chris, they have to have the sin and then they have to have the redemption. It doesn't work.
Wait a minute.
They can't just have.
What are they there
exactly.
to help? Are they there to help me masturbate?
Well, if you do masturbate, they're to help you stop, apparently. And, you know.
Stop or finish, because.
20% of women are addicted to porn. I mean.
I mean, they must have really hot, like, porn fantasies, because the more guilt you get,
the more
guilty you are, the harder you come. So we are here once again with some members of the Getting It staff, and I'm looking over here at Patrick Hughes and Steve Robles. And Robles, he was like a lurking figure who was always there, but was never hired.
I was, something that came up like a little bit later, and I always like kind of resented it. And it turned out that nobody even knew that I wanted to get hired. I was sitting there in the back in the dark, and nobody had any idea that I even had that ambition. But I think
we didn't think you could pass the urine test that we gave.
Okay, explain what you were doing and there was like this weird closet behind the office.
Yeah, well, I was sometimes
with no air, no air conditioning whatsoever.
Sometimes I was writing for Getting It, but mostly I was still writing for Web Power, the other part of the Al Hadhazy empire, and I was also smoking lots of pot, which was a lot of fun. But Yeah, I didn't even know that, like, because I wasn't even writing. Like, the one thing about it, when getting it started, because I was working for WebPower before getting it, when getting it was still this weird thing that I remember, like, Doug and Jeff used to have, like, these getting
Doug,
it.
I don't know if it, do we bother to explain Doug?
Nah. No, not really. He can just be a non sequitur. But they used to have these getting it screensavers, and I always used to wonder what the hell that was all about. This was months before even getting it even got launched, and they used to have horrible, horrible screaming arguments. In fact, even then. In fact, now I see a pattern, because me and you have those same horrible screaming arguments to this day.
I hope they're not about the same thing, because those arguments were about with Kara was involved with those too. As another person that's not here,
Kara
so we can't
was working
really
at the WebPower at the time, and yes, she edited our sex section, which was called what?
Crave.
Crave. Thank you.
Yeah.
They were all 5-letter words. We were so fucking clever.
Oh man.
Yeah.
Five letters. Yeah.
I wrote for a few of those sections, actually. I don't think I wrote for every single one.
You were obsessed with Waco.
With Waco.
Waco, Texas.
Waco. Oh, Waco. Yeah, that was the very first thing I did. Fresh. And, like, I remember you loved that, and Paul McHenry fucking hated it. And I remember when I first came in and started working on it, I didn't even know who Paul was. And, like, I just knew you, and I knew Jeff, and I thought these were the bosses. And Paul came up to me, and he was just like,
that was his section.
Yeah, he was getting little bits of it, and he was like, what is this fucking crap?
But I edited your stuff for the Waco. It wasn't Paul.
No, but because I think there was one day where I was working in the office and RU was out. And so Paul was being RU. And that was a difficult position, because RU loved it and Paul hated it. And I remember when I was so excited because I actually got, like, good feedback from that. And, like, Paul totally, you know, resentfully gave me my fucking little bit of fan mail, and he was just like, yeah, well, whatever whenever you pitch to that flaky crowd, that's what you get. It's like, thanks, Paul. I didn't even know until talking to Jeff and Kara years later that maybe I could have actually got hired on the staff if I would have let people know that
I
had given up writing completely when I was working at WebPower before getting it launched, and it was because of Jeff and Kara that I even thought of writing again. And,
well, we didn't cajole people in general. We had we had a dollar a word, so we didn't have to cajole.
Yeah, but then you had people like me who were like the thing that wouldn't go away.
Yeah.
You wouldn't go away, but you came in kind of late in the game, as
well.
I
what
recall.
Happened was I got
and
involved.
We had our sort of floating crap game. You and me and McHenry, we'd been moving from magazine to magazine
over the course
trying
of years.
To earn a living.
I will name check. Fred Dodsworth was
Fred,
the
sure.
last
Freddy
incarnation. We had an magazine called Access, which was the mid-90s. We did 3 issues, and it died.
Yeah.
And then there was some other online thing that we jumped to. And then when getting it got started, I had been trying to make a go as a freelance writer. And there was no gigs that would hire somebody with no track record. But I kept saying, like, you know, I've worked with these people. And they would be like, who are they? Mm-hmm. And so I was literally, when the idea of getting it came along, I mean, even back in March, I was being the annoying presence that had all these ideas and would come by all the time and ended up sort of just commandeering a computer in a corner and just started writing stories from there, and people just sort of kind of let me do it without saying anything. And it wasn't until December of 1999 when I guess you had gone through like a half a dozen receptionist.
Oh my god. And you, I have to say, you were the least hot receptionist.
Well,
that they
that's
ever.
All right. I can take that. There was all these receptionists.
I
so
forgot
they,
you had a dual role there.
Yeah, yeah, because I had left to go. I was writing freelance for, you know, I was like, you know, article or two a week. And then I got hired by Warren Hinkle to work on his, you know, Execrable Argonaut, which is basically, you know, I was hired to dig dirt on.
Doesn't he talk like a pirate?
Yeah, he pretty much talks like a pirate. So I got hired away.
And you got to experience, like, the core of San Francisco political corruption.
But that's
a whole other story.
Yeah, that's a whole other story. And I eventually left, and it was kind of this thing where I found out some dirt on Tom Amiano, like actual real stuff. You know, and I
well,
sort of
do tell.
Yeah, why don't you tell
us news here?
All right, we'll break the news. Apparently, one of the patronage
he's
gigs,
gay.
One of the patronage things that they do in San Francisco, and again, I'm this is years afterwards, so I'm fuzzy on the details. But when he got elected to the school board, as you know, it's sort of a it's a process you go through in San Francisco to be an elected official, and you get your like your college board or
Rudy
your school board.
Yeah.
Well, he got elected to the school board, and what the Democratic apparatus had given him a patronage job that he didn't have to go to or anything like that, so he could become a full-time politician. And that's how basically it works in San Francisco. And I found this out by like doing research on in the Chronicle dating back to you know the 80s, and there was a few other like he was sued for some stuff or whatever. I mean, I don't remember. I just decided that that kind of journalism wasn't something I could really get behind.
But you were in the serious of, section behind, of the magazine.
The you know his name when spoken phonetically in Spanish means I take it up the ass.
Does it really?
Toma mi ano.
Oh, I thought you meant Patrick Hughes.
Patrick Hughes.
I would,
oh, that too.
Believe me, I would have heard of that before. School kids can be so cruel.
So there was a lot of crazy shit going on that year.
Yeah, but that was a great thing. I got to write some fun stuff. I mean, the two...
Well, I just got slipped a note by Matt Honan that says that Patrick was the first to do a big story on Matt Gonzalez.
Yeah, he was running for DA.
And this is all San Francisco politics. Might not mean
anything to anybody, but Matt Gonzalez became the first Green Party Board of Supervisors member.
And mayoral
he ran for mayor against... pretty
Gavin
boy.
Newsom.
Gavin Newsom and lost by just a little bit.
Well, I think actually a more interesting piece was the one you did about Amok.
Yeah,
Amok
I'm
publishers.
Still, a little peaked about that. Because
happened with Amok and with our...
All right, Amok Press is a... you know, anomalous information publisher based out of L.A., you know, serial killers, you know, forensic pictures of bloated bodies left in the sun in the tropics, that sort of thing. Yep. And they have a thing called the Amok Reader that came out on a semi-regular basis. Right. And Stuart and I go way back, because my background is in working with
Stuart
publishers. Stuart Sweeney. And he had done... the most recent Reader, which was a compilation of, like, things that doctors and emergency rooms have found in people's asses, certain types of...
a lot of light bulbs, I think.
Yeah, light bulbs, you know, quick drying cement, and then the thing where they wrap themselves up in things, like a carpet, and just all, very, very bizarre sex stuff. And so I found out, you know, the book was coming out, and I said, all right, let's do an interview. And so I do an interview with Stuart Swayze, and, you know, we were veering off subject, and it goes on to, like, all these other stuff, and, like, where the bodies are buried, and people who have done Stuart Swayze wrong, and whatnot, and I kind of left it all out, but and I just did this, like, what was considered by my betters at getting it to be a very dry piece about the new Reader,
and
so...
we were better.
Huh?
Never mind. We were better, I said.
Oh, okay. And then so when RU and Paul McInerney, who was my editor on the piece, got hold of it, they were like, you know, this is really dry. Let me see the transcripts. Well, they go back to the transcripts that Amy Rasmussen, who I need to give a shout out, was always wonderful that did transcribing for a lot of my interviews, who's not here, but she was a good part of getting it. They get hold of the interview, and in it, he's like dogging Gary Baddeley and
Adam Parfrey, a friend of the show.
And who's Disinfo, the other guy from Disinfo?
Metzger?
Yeah,
Metzger.
And so they're like, no, this is the interesting stuff.
Right.
So I go back to Stuart, and I say, well, they've kind of changed the focus of the article from, you know, it's talking about this to this whole feud, this L.A. feud over the forming of Amok Press, Amok Book, which is a legendary bookstore, as well as Feral House, which was a legendary imprint that does also transgressive and anomalous information. So then, you know, I started having to ask Stuart, like, really sort of embarrassing questions about, well, what did you mean by when you said this about Gary Baddeley? And then, you know, I got this quote from Metzger, who basically said, Stuart Swayze's a cunt. You know, and they were like, great, print that. So
and did
was,
we? I don't remember.
No. You printed the whole thing, and it took it took at least 5 years before Stuart would talk to me again.
I'm glad to know we ruined a few people's.
But the other one I wanted to talk about that was a great article that I still think it was Michael Savage, who's gone on to become really super famous as one of these sort of like radio fascists. You know, there's no limit to their like. He was the Ann Coulter of his day. I mean, his star has fallen a little bit. But I did a piece where the local radio station KSFO did this sort of like convention down at Fort Mason, where it was like, you know, come meet the only true Republicans in San Francisco. And you know, Mike
Lenny
Savage,
Reifenstahl will be there.
Yeah, no, but Mike Savage, whose his real name is Mike Wiener, and
That's right.
And is published several books on homeopathy and like, you know, green foods. You know,
well, he used to be a hippie.
Yeah, he was a total hippie, but then suddenly took this.
He used to hang out with Ginsburg. He actually, I heard, he guarded the gate at Millbrook in like the 60s.
Well, so the way they set this thing up is like, you know, all the true Republicans left in San Francisco, which is something, you know, it's like what, a dozen, two dozen, and they're all like old or conspiracy theories or whatnot. And so you go into this convention. And literally set up in the middle of it was this bulletproof booth, you know, for Michael Savage to be able to give his talk to the adoring masses. And there's only like 50 people there. I mean, it's really a very sparsely attended thing. And he goose-steps in.
Has great theatrics.
Yeah, great theatrics. And he has got the bodyguards and he's got the full-on leather duster and comes like, you know, stomping into the thing, gives his whole speech about, you know, what's wrong with San Francisco and what's right with KSFO or whatnot. And he was doing all these things like in preparation for, I guess, the eventual assassination that didn't happen. But he did make a point of pointing me out as a member of the Albanian media. You know, because he saw I had my notebook out because I couldn't, you know, he's just like, you know, I'm for culture and for borders. I mean, all these like really crazy, that's common, you know, nomenclature now, but right. In 99, we hadn't really sort of slipped into that kind of like fascist rhetoric as commonplace now. So it was quite humorous because it was a small audience and a lot of Arthur Carlson comb-overs. You know, I'm a smoker with an attitude, you know.
Well, it's too bad that McHenry didn't show up because he was the editor of your section. I did want to get a chance. Maybe, Jeff, you'd like to speak to this. We ran some, and this was the section where we sort of did our real, quote-unquote, reportage. And we ran
politics,
some,
yeah.
We ran some pretty serious stuff, and we had a guy in East Timor.
Yeah, actually. Remember at the same time as me, because I was doing a series about Clinton was about to offer clemency, what do you call it, pardons. Right. And the FALN, which was the Puerto Rican insurrection.
FALN.
FALN, yeah, well. FALN, yeah. No, but at the same time, we had a guy who actually I got to know pretty well.
So that guy was all, we wrote him up as anonymous, though. Who was that guy?
I wish I could remember, but he was staying with me for a little while. He was a friend of Eric Drucker's.
Oh, really?
I don't remember his name, but he was definitely part of that.
And we had pieces on Columbine happened then. I think we had
a few pieces that were kind of marginally about Columbine.
Right, there was a Mark Derry piece about, I think that was about a guy going postal, actually. I think that was a postman who shot a bunch of people, but it was around the same time.
You did.
And Seattle. Battle of Seattle.
Yeah, Battle of Seattle.
I did a piece
on
that, too.
Did we end up with a small interview with Zerzan or just somebody talking about Zerzan?
No, I think there was a brief interview with Zerzan.
No, I got to talk. I knew Zerzan from publishing, so I got a piece from him. It was the thing about they were arresting. I mean, it's all moot now after 9/11. You know, I mean, they can come and take all of your shit and stick you in a box somewhere. Right. But back in 99, we were all getting kind of bent out of shape that the cops had rules that they could go in and take everything. And there was like this one kid that was at an anti-Nike demonstration in Portland.
Right.
Or some other small town in Washington, Oregon, or something like that.
He's in Eugene.
Yeah, he was in Eugene, and he had gone to a Nike thing, and then the cops, they're eating breakfast or dinner or something like that, and the cops showed up and cleared the house out, took all the computers, took everything, including the parents' computers and whatnot, saying that, you know, it was all used for commission of a crime, and this was like a little kid. But, I mean, you think of that story
now. I remember that story, yeah. There's one of those every few days, actually. Well, I think Steve Robles is burning to say something, and then we're going to have to break.
Am I burning to say something?
I see you. I see you leaning into the microphone.
I always lean into the microphone, but I did want to say. I mean, Andy was talking about how, you know, getting it meant to him, and how it affected the rest of his life and his career. And I feel exactly the same way. Getting it basically resuscitated my whole interest in writing, which has since completely died off. But
I forgot to mention that you ruined my career.
Yes, and I think maybe it's possible that my biggest contribution to getting it was getting Are You Serious fired from Web Power, which I don't take total responsibility for. I think it was Jeff's friends that trashed the building. But it was probably not a good idea to have
coworkers. They weren't my friends.
A big drug fueled, party
all night.
At the former corporate offices of Getting It.
What's so funny about that? The reason the person and of course, the people that they abused was called Law.com. They had torn the sign off the front of their offices. Now, that's not. That's number
that
one.
Where you worked?
Number one, a bad idea. But then the second bit was how the way they caught them is they went down and looked at the videotapes from the front entrance and seeing like 100 people. Like coming and going at like 10, 12 o'clock, 2 o'clock in the morning.
A video of Kara and her boyfriend Joe carrying out like $500 worth of Getting an infrastructure, like monitors and chairs and all kinds of crap. Loading it into a fucking taxi down
not
a fucking
funny,
Kurt.
I was getting $50,000 a year to do nothing.
No, and I'll tell you, I really honestly did feel really bad, and anybody who is... Ever
I wonder
had
how long that could have lasted. I mean, just to, like,
no, you told
once,
me. You
once,
said
like
it was
every
ask
3 months, I'd reboot their computer for them. Or something.
You said it was going to last another 6 months, and if anybody has ever heard, "Are you angry?" It's the scariest fucking thing in the world, because after the day after he got fired, he'd left a fucking voicemail on my cell phone saying, "You owe me $50,000."
Okay,
I'm still waiting to collect.
Right about this, because just put it in context. There was a period then when we've all had we were offered this ability to get paid the wages that we were if we stayed.
Right.
Okay. Yeah. So all of us eventually had gotten bored and wandered off to other jobs. And so I remember going to the office for the party. All the plants were dead. There were a pile, maybe about 3 or 4 feet high, of unread Wall Street journals, all stacked
pile,
by the front door. I mean,
a
it was pretty much
that high abused whippet.
Yeah, it was kind of like, you know, like that bit in AI, you know,
best,
they
crank, best job I ever had.
Yeah, it's kind of like at the end of AI, they crank open the vault and there's our you, just frozen in time with that those funky Mac laptops they had, you know, the orange and white laptops.
Yeah, I still have that laptop.
All right, but the last, even though he's not here, we have to do one anecdote about Paul McInerney. One of the great things that was taken advantage of at Getting It was the ability to punch bowl surf. Which is get invites to the most ridiculous like industry launches.
He started that with Mondo 2000.
Yes, I mean, we called it punch bowl surfing. And my favorite one of all was we went to some forgettable software launch. But it was in like the Clift Hotel, really fancy place, and they were having martinis and past foods and whatnot. But I mean, to tell you what the product was, I would never remember because it was completely that was still in the era where big ideas.
Right.
We're gonna do this.
All
we're gonna take over this.
Yeah, right.
So we're in the Clift Hotel, and Kara Bruce was there as well, and Paul McInerney in full pink jacket regalia, he was known for, cocktail in hand, walking back to the main area because they do the marketing weasel bits and then you entertain, and it was a glass wall that went across. But being the Clift Hotel, it was well polished. And so there's Paul, martini in hand, walking straight into the glass wall, shattering the glass in his hand. He drops like a sack of potatoes, like spurting blood like you wouldn't believe. It brings all the security people over, and McInerney, who was 7 sheets to the wind at this point, is getting belligerent. I need no help. But like he's cut an artery. I need no help. And they got these guys, these security guys, where you sign these documents, I'm not going to sign nothing.
I'm not going to sign your fucking documents.
Needless to say, I think the representatives of Getting It were never invited back to any of those software lines. Thank you very much.
All right. We'll hear some tunes.
Are you serious?
Station announcer, station announcer. Packing your lips in the form of salty.
delicious, nauseating corn. Get into your ass. Why don't we all relax and just get terribly friendly?
Saying good night. Good night, little kids. Good night. We're off? Good. Well, that ought to hold the little bastards.
Are you serious?
We are back again with Annalee Newitz, who has actually been on this show before in another capacity, and you probably know her weekly column that appears all over the goddamn place called Texploitation. And I'll even mention her new book because she brought me a copy of it. It's called Pretend We're Dead, Capitalist Monsters in American Pop Culture. And we also have Thomas Roach, who has gone on to become the editor of Eros Zine. And he's also written a whole bunch of dirty books under assumed names. So maybe we'll get a chance. But actually, we have to acknowledge Jeff Deal, who is really the project director. What was your title again? L. Jeff A.
He was editor in chief. Called director.
Uber boss
I called it director.
He was Uberman, and you got to do some interesting thing. But to tell the Ross Jeffries story.
Well, the Ross Jeffries thing comes up because of a recent bestseller by Neil Strauss, who was a writer for. He wrote for New York Times and also for Rolling Stone. He wrote a couple of rock star biographies.
A fantastic Marilyn Manson biography.
Was it good?
Yeah, I liked it.
So after he had already accomplished that stuff as a writer, he decides the only thing that's lacking in my life is that I don't have success with women, because he's kind of a dopey-looking guy, frail, little balding dude. So he finds out about this pickup artist scene and decides to check it out, finds it intriguing, infiltrates them, becomes one of them, makes best friends with the top-notch dude, and learns all his tricks, and becomes the top pickup artist in the world. He's charging $1,200 a night for these pimply geeks to come out to nightclubs, and he shows you how to pick up women. A pretty interesting book, but the reason that it's relevant to Ross Jeffries is that he meets Ross Jeffries along the way.
And Ross Jeffries is the guy you did an article about.
He's the original. Yeah, he was the speed seduction guy. He still is. And there were a couple articles on him at gettingit.com. And the one that I did with Kara Bruce was that we went down to one of his workshops. He invited us to go check it out. And we suffered through one of his workshops. Impressive just by their sheer intimidation level. The point was, the guy was a bit of a nut. And so now reading about Ross Jeffries in this book is interesting, because where he's at now is he's sort of struggling to maintain his relevance. There's a younger generation of these guys, and Ross Jeffries never took people out into nightclubs to demonstrate his stuff. He would just give them the theoretical crap and do stuff in the classroom. These guys are the next generation. So Ross Jeffries is sort of trying to stay relevant and also trying to intimidate these new up-and-comers to maintain his, so he can maintain his business.
But Jeff, you're not telling us the most important part of the story.
Well,
but how you met him.
Oh.
What condition were you in?
Yeah, tell us about the condition of your mind. Were you feeling impressionable or vulnerable at all? Or?
Was Kara feeling a lot of love all around her?
So before the conference started, we had some substances in our possession, and we figured, well, you know, this is bizarre enough. We might as well just go all the way and blow this thing out. So we dropped some ecstasy before the class started, and. Kara was already really tired. I guess she'd been drinking heavily the night before or something. She falls asleep in the classroom right at the beginning, wakes up about an hour later, completely tripping her ass off, and with Ross Jeffries like in her face saying, "Wake up, wake up." She doesn't even remember where she's at this point, spinning. And he instantly singles us out as like, we're the gettingit.com crew, we're second class citizens, don't pay them any mind, like just trying to really, I don't know what his goal was there, because I mean, we're going to write about him eventually, and what did he thought he was gaining from that, I don't know.
Psychological warfare.
So anyway, we left that detail out of the piece that we published eventually about the ecstasy, but Kara wrote another piece later on that that actually mentioned it, and Ross Jeffries read that, and at that point got onto the gettingit.com website, posted a comment about how, you know, you can't trust anything we say because we were on ecstasy and blah, blah, blah.
No, you can't testify in court if you've ever taken a psychedelic drug.
Right,
I think they showed that during the OJ trial. There was
That's years later.
Yeah. Years later. And that just shows the mentality of this guy. But to wrap it up about
ego
Ross
surfing.
Jeffries.
A lot of ego surfing.
Neil Strauss, the new guy. Finally succumbs to Ross Jeffries pleading to take him to a party where he can meet celebrities, because he wants to hit on celebrity chicks. So finally he takes him to some party, and there's like all these celebrities there, and one of them is Carmen Electra. And I guess Ross Jeffries is obsessed with Carmen Electra. This story's in the book, The Game by Neil Strauss. You can read it. And so eventually they had to leave because Ross Jeffries was walking around on all fours sniffing Carmen Electra's ass the whole party and wouldn't leave from her rear area, so they had to leave the party.
I wish I could see that.
He was ingesting a little substance maybe before his.
I think he's just.
He's just gone. He's doing the slow seduction now. It's not so speedy anymore. Yeah.
Inhaling Carmen Electra's ass for you.
That's a little too speedy, actually. It's like,
yeah,
you skipped
so.
A few steps
it's
there.
It's hard to get. It's like cutting right to the ass. It's not always.
I don't know. Has he written about this as one of his tactics? Does this usually work for him?
Well, no. That's
Power
the thing.
Your
is
dog.
That
there is a certain kind. It's complimentary. You know, it's not a.
Yeah, I mean, it's a dog thing. It's a dog thing. Iggy could do it.
It could work in certain contexts.
Maybe once you're in the bedroom, but if you still got a cocktail in your hand,
yeah.
I don't know
how
if you
how do you hold the cocktail in the all fours? Yeah, I don't know.
It could be rough.
It's a dark. It's a dark
night.
But I think that there's a certain. It sort of reminds me of getting at meetings, you know, the tale of the, you know, sniffing
and drugs. We used to sniff
each
other's butts for a few minutes right before
but,
I
yeah,
start.
Yeah, that's true. Like, no, the butt sniffing definitely, but also just the, you know, multiple kinds of intoxication. And
I'm not
and
saying I wasn't inspired by him, you know.
And sort of
the game, actually, they showed that on an episode of CSI Miami. That was pretty fun. So, Anna Lee, what was your weirdest experience of getting it?
My weirdest experience?
Your weirdest article.
My weirdest article. You know, there were a lot. I actually was writing for Getting It the whole time that it was going, and
that's
I remember seeing an ad on Craigslist or something for it, and so I actually had an article in, it was either the first or second issue, but you guys had sat on it for a long time, like 3 months or something, and it was called They Wrecked My Genitals. It was actually kind of a serious article about
put a lovely headline.
Yeah, I actually loved the title. Like at first, I was a little taken aback, and then I was like, "Yeah, this is kind of cool." But it was actually about intersex people, and you know, like I said, it was actually kind of serious. I have no idea what the intersex community thought of the title, but I think they were okay with it. I mean, I didn't get any hate mail or anything like that. But so later in the magazine's life, I came on board as an editor, and which was like really awesome. And so one of the weird things was just getting paid at all, because I had been a grad student for like 7 years, and so I'd been writing sort of hyper theoretical essays about mass culture and Foucault, and suddenly people were paying me to publish articles about cannibalism, and which was awesome. The headlines were great, and so my first editorial meeting, I came in, and it was near Thanksgiving. And so everybody was saying, like, okay, you know, we have to have, like, a Thanksgiving theme. Like, all week long, we're going to publish, like, Thanksgiving-related articles. So we need articles about monkey eating, eating brains, and how to covertly drug your family. Okay, all right, everybody, go. I was like, wow, it's worth this it to get downtown planet. By 10 o'clock just to, you know, be at the pitch meeting, you know. So that was pretty great.
Were there any writers that you dealt with that who gave you aches and pains?
So I actually had really good writers. I was lucky. But there is actually one writer who I retroactively now sort of feel is a pain. This is Julia Shears, who actually wrote a piece for us about getting a nose job.
Oh, right.
She sold it to me as a memoir piece. Right. And, you know, now she's subsequently become quite well known for doing this memoir, Jesus Land, which came out around the same time as the website Jesus Land. And so everyone thought they were related, but actually they were totally unrelated. But so apparently now she's denying that her nose job piece is true. And
she wrote it, right?
She wrote it. She said it was true. And it was this fantastic graphic piece about how she got a nose job and came home from the hospital and woke up, like, choking and vomiting on blood.
It gets a lot of comments still on the site.
Yeah, it's a fantastic, you know, it's just really disgusting. And the whole piece is very much about how she wanted to turn herself into this perfect L.A. skinny blonde. And it's this very satirical, confessional piece. And now she says it's all fiction, even though she actually looks
she's
had a nose job.
Usually what we're used to these days is other people revealing that something, you know, like J.T. LeRoy or whatever.
Yeah, that it's fake.
She's trying to stir something up here by...
Go the other way.
giving it away herself.
Huh. Yeah, so I don't know. I mean, so need to know if she actually had a nose job. Maybe we need to have, like, an investigative report. Like,
what would be her reason for denying that she had a nose? Because that's like a trivial thing these days, if you had a nose job.
I think, well, I mean, maybe she feels like, you know, she doesn't want to be associated with that kind of culture anymore. Because it's really, I mean, the article,
her
she sort of ends it by saying...
Her therapist told her that she has to tell the truth about everything she's ever
she
lied
ends
about.
The article by saying, I am now an L.A. bimbo with a dumb boyfriend. And so, you know, maybe she doesn't want people to think her boyfriend's dumb, or I don't know. So it's a mystery. I think it needs further investigation.
So Thomas, you were relegated to the unlikely job of having to copy edit.
Copy edit and product reviews editor.
And product reviews
editor. That's right.
Yes. Which is what still goes on my resume.
Is it really?
Product reviews editor, yes.
And in the process of doing this, did you decide you wanted to kill us all? No.
I had been writing for GothicNet, but it was really, you know, GothicNet was a real sort of shoestring thing, and it was kind of whatever I wanted to do. I didn't get a lot of direction. And it was my first experience in a real intense editorial capacity, you know, a really intense environment where people were really, like, going over articles and these, like, 600-word articles that we'd just edit. We'd crank them out, but we would put a lot of attention into how they were written, and they'd be really tight. And it was really the first time that I wrote any large degree of nonfiction. I had published, at that point, probably 100 short stories, but very little nonfiction.
I'm trying to remember what the hell kind of products we would even...
Everything.
We had something about mouse poop.
We actually turned
tech gadgets
we
too,
turned
right?
one of the dildos into a pencil holder, and then we reviewed it as a pencil holder.
Yeah, we had a dildo review, but actually I think somebody else may have written that review. but no, we did a lot of stuff like moose poop Christmas ornaments and like weird crappy stuff that people would sell on the web that was like from tourist shops. I reviewed some handguns.
Oh, those aliens that could stick to the wall that you
exactly.
throw against the wall. That was a big deal.
It was right in the middle of the extreme candy trend where there was all this candy that tasted really, really bad, which is now like
extreme candy.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so I reviewed stuff like that. But yeah, it was pretty random. Now it's like I was doing 3 articles a week. So that doesn't seem like that many now.
Right.
But at the time, it was a lot.
Thomas did so much work. I mean, there was like a carpet of like Advil and Sudafed bottles around his desk. I remember coming in and there was a kind of sort of explosion of over-the-counter.
You still take Sudafed? You have to give your driver's license
now?
To get Sudafed.
It's true.
It's true.
It's true.
I experienced it. I couldn't believe it.
Possibly with the exception of Andy, Thomas and Amy were probably the people who were there the latest. at night.
Yeah,
right.
It was a hard
Amy
job.
Also
because they also did fact-checking.
Fact-checking.
Which is hard to do on a magazine where half the shit was made up.
So. Yeah, but then
check this fact.
And you didn't really know what had been made up. But people would claim it was true. And
check the facts on this false article.
I know, like the article, email from the dead. Like, how do you check the facts on that? Like, there were actual expert sources cited.
But the thing is, you have to check, like, to make sure that if a movie is mentioned, that movie was really published, it was really, it was really released in that year and stuff like that. So a lot of the details, which I think lent itself to sort of my having a little bit of a hard-ass attitude toward details in writing, which was good, which weighs into what I'm doing now, so.
Yeah, I mean, we could have been pretty goofy with it, but we actually
I think
tight articles.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, it was pretty serious.
It was the first time
how serious it was.
It was the first time that I had ever actually, like, I mean, I was used to writing 4,000 or 5,000 words, 7,500 word novellas, and then I got to getting it, and they were like, "No, man, this is 400 words, too long," you know. And I was like, "Jesus Christ!" You know, how do you just cut things
Make
so
it
short to be so quick and so punchy?
Can I hop in for one second? This is Andy. I was just checking the stats, the logs on getting it, and currently for this month, the third most popular article is one of yours, Thomas's, called "Playing Baby," which is about infantilism.
Adult babies.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Adult babies.
Wow.
Excellent. Yeah, we had a lot of fetish-related articles. Like, here's a fetish you never heard of.
That's people. Back when adult babies were really on the edge.
Yeah, they were.
Now they're not mainstream. You know,
yeah, it's like so. That's like so 1999. Yeah.
We actually had to make some fetishes up. I wrote an article that was total bullshit about people lighting their genitals on fire.
I remember. I was about to mention that. That was that we were like at the the dawn of the era of genital fire. People.
That article fucking ruined
pyrogenitalia.
Me, man.
Pyrogenitalphilia. Yeah. People do that now, though.
I was just going to say, was Semen Warriors of New Guinea by Hank Hyena our most, is that our most popular?
Is that the one where he tasted his sperm?
Did he taste his sperm? No, I think
he did.
Different.
But he Hank Hyena did an article where he ate. Was it his urine?
I think he did both.
He did both. He did
different articles.
He was a trooper for us.
He was great. He would eat different things and then taste his cum or his urine. And later, I think he admitted that maybe he hadn't done the. He'd done the urine tasting, but not
really
the semen tasting because he wanted to save up or something. I don't know.
Because that would be gay.
That would be gay, exactly. I'm straight. I don't need my own cum, but drinking piss, that's a manly thing. Everybody's into a little urine drinking, especially getting it.
Didn't Hank almost always come up with those crazy ideas?
Yes.
It's not like we asked Hank to drink his own pee.
No.
Volunteer. Yeah.
He pitched that story.
Yeah, he pitched it. He really was a trooper. Great.
That's what we liked about Hank the most, was that his ideas were always right on with our voice and our overall mission.
Yeah, part of our mission. Like, when I went on to the Bay Guardian, he wrote for me, and he wrote this great piece about people who come in and clean up after violent death. The corpse cleaners, and it was all about, like if your brains are blown out, who comes in and cleans up? Well, it was these guys. They had hazmat suits and the big spray bottles, and so Hank was right there.
You brought a lot of the getting it tone over to your culture editor position at The Guardian.
It's true. Yeah. I brought the getting it tone into the culture section. Guardian. And in fact, Thomas Roche caused the most controversy ever with his necrophilia article at the Guardian. Yeah, I had to talk to a lot of angry feminists that day when that article came out. And I just kept saying, hey, we're sex positive here. We don't endorse killing, but if people are turned on by death, we're not going to censor them. We're free speech kind of organization here.
I remember Annalie also took a lot of heat for the corporate heroin junkie.
Yeah,
piece,
written by Anonymous. An anonymous getting it contributor.
Anonymous getting it contributor, and they gave her a lot of bullshit because she didn't want to say who it was or didn't want to publish who it was. I forget who it. I think
the person who wrote it.
Well, the fact checker had to know.
I think Tim Redmond and maybe one or two other people on the staff had to know who it was.
Yeah, they knew who it was. But it was called "I Was a .com Junkie."
I remember that.
So just guess which .com it was, where the junkie was.
Yeah.
.comming.
Go figure.
Actually, it brings me to my last question. Does everybody remember having to fill out a form that the company forced us to fill in? What were some of the questions on
I
that form?
I never filled in the form.
You didn't?
No, I refused.
It was like the employee evaluation. It was like a pre-employment survey.
Anybody who wants to walk up, come on up. It's a free-for-all at this point.
And they asked if you'd ever done any drugs.
Out of time, though.
They asked if you'd done any drugs, and my immediate thought was, What am I supposed to say? Well, I'm going to say no. I wonder what RU is going
to
say.
I have to say the very first thing I did almost when I got to getting it was drugs. So it was like my first day. Someone, I think it might have been Matt, said, oh, you know, we have this spot. You just climb out the window here on the roof, and it's a great place to
Jeff
get high.
Jeff yelled at me for smoking pot out there.
Yeah, Jeff
day.
Would get
I
mad
quit,
at us.
I quit.
Basically, his attitude was, do it in your office, you know?
I'm sorry. I apologize.
We didn't have offices.
I stayed pretty straight while I was there. I figured I was editor-in-chief.
So. Oh, yeah. Except for the carpet of sort of whippet containers.
Well, no, after everybody left and I was there alone, I won't even begin to go into
it. The Whippet container was kind of an office decoration.
In terms of a score, I believe, now this was across the entire WebPower universe, not just getting it. Everyone who wanted to work for WebPower had to fill out this.
Say they don't take drugs.
This whole thing. In the office. They had to fill out. Well,
was it printed out or was it online?
I never filled out anything.
Well, anyway,
I didn't fill out anything, and I didn't give my social security number.
Well, what happened was that of this survey or whatever, this kind of like employment.
I'm not sure. Oh, no, I didn't show you my social security card.
Hang on.
I scored the lowest ever.
Very good.
Who scored the highest ever?
The purity test.
And I was told...
Andy?
Andy, this is Andy. I was told that I had the highest score forever.
Yeah, it was the getting it purity test, definitely.
All right, well, I think that's it. And I want to thank all you getting it people for...
And Al Hadassah for making it.
Love's the only weapon. Shit!
Are you serious?